I'm Trish Halpin.
And I'm Lorraine Candy.
Welcome to Postcards from Midlife, the show where we help you through the midlife, the menopause, motherhood, and everything in between.
Today, we're going to be talking about why society doesn't want to talk about the menopause, a taboo we're working hard to change with this very podcast, in fact. Our special guest is TV presenter Louise Minchin, who spearheaded the BBC's Menopause Week last year, filming her own experience of whether or not to go on HRT.
Louise joined us just before she headed off to Namibia to take part in the grueling Sport Relief Desert Adventure, so she talks about that too. Later in the episode, we're going to be sharing our trials and tribulations as four of our six children prepare for their GCSEs and A-levels in the coming months. But first, though, Trish, I found some old photographs of myself. And actually, I thought I was going to be horrified because I remember having my picture taken at the time I was on holiday and thinking, oh, I've got terrible skin, I've got lots of spots, I haven't been able to brush my hair. I looked amazing.
I know.
I was 22 in Greece. I was just thinking, why didn't I at the time think, this is great, I'm having the time of my life.
You were gorgeous.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yes. There was no context. It was just brilliant. It's really lovely to look. But I should have thought about it at the time.
I think, well, we're just so critical of ourselves in photos, aren't we? And I've got a friend, actually, we just went to her 50th birthday party. And I sent her what I thought was a really lovely picture that I took on the night. That's sober at the time, obviously, before the wine had kicked in. And she texted back going, oh, I look really fat. And I was like, no, you don't. You look gorgeous.
It's funny, isn't it?
We can't kind of see the niceness. And I agree with you about looking at old photos because I kind of had the same thing, apart from the only downer is some of the dreadful haircuts.
Oh, yes.
The perm, the permed bob.
I think anyone who is over 45 has had a perm. Oh, yeah. I think it was an 80s rite of passage.
It was. Mm.
I had one where the front of my fringe fell off. It just broke
it
off.
It just burned off.
It was very cheaply
done. Do you remember the smell of the perming solution?
Oh, God, yeah. I also did a really stupid thing. I've dyed my hair many colours, but I had it cut about 9 years ago, 10 years ago, and I had it dyed black. I mean, I'm a natural blonde, so it was a bit, it was kind of pulp fiction, Uma Thurman black, had it cut into a bob, and it was horrible. I looked absolutely awful. I found those pictures the other day. It took 2 years
to grow it out.
To get rid
of
that.
You can't have had it very long.
No, I was that. After 6 weeks, I was just went, in such a downward funk about the whole thing. It had to go.
But I do think physical photos are just, you know, obviously they're not a thing anymore, but they're so brilliant. We actually got my in-laws brought round these old photo albums the other day with all of their parents' childhood. So we've got literally like great granny Dora sitting in a chair in 1920 with her sister Maud, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And the kids loved it. They really, really loved going through the albums and trying to find out who was who.
When you were little. So my granny and granddad, we never went abroad ever. And then they won some money or something happened and they went to Cyprus.
Oh.
But they drove because they didn't want
drove
to fly.
Drove to Cyprus?
Very long drive. But when they got back, they had a slideshow.
Oh, yes, slides.
And it was such a big thing that they'd been abroad. And we all had to go. It was like a massive major event. We had to look through this slideshow of granny in a deck chair. I mean, she could have been on Brighton Beach.
It was bless.
But what was really brilliant is I remember now how she used to tie her little headscarves in her hair and all the little things that she was wearing, the little trainers that she wore. And I just remember it really set in my memory. I must have been really young. But we watched the slideshow. Can you imagine having a slideshow?
I know. Well, it was always that thing, wasn't it, where you were like, oh, God, so they're going to bring out the holiday photos. You'd get them back from Snappy Snaps and then you'd have to sit through and look at them doing all their different things
in
Tenerife.
You do that, though,
well,
don't
I do.
You?
Well, I do. Well, I'm not organised. I make my husband, this is what you want for Christmas. I'm like, well, you know what I want for Christmas. I want a book.
And the other thing I want, Neil.
I want a book of photos of the year. So it's like the most arduous and actual sort of task of love.
He is a photographer.
I know, but he's the busman's holiday, not interested when he's
shame.
Off the job, as it were. But he does put a lot of time and effort into doing one of those, you know, you just can do them online. So at least I do have a physical book with like random photos of the year, which I just love. I just think there's something about that tangible, not just on a phone.
It's very bonding, isn't it? That kind of thing. I know that a lot of family therapists who work with families who are going through trauma or tragedy or have recovered from some event will ask them over a month to keep a photo diary, and then it will all be combined, and then you'll sit down as a family and look through the diary and talk about it. And it's very good for people emotionally. It's very good on bringing families together, giving them something to talk about, and actually focusing on the really great things that have happened in a month when they may have gone through something really terrible, but there will be moments that bring you up. So I think everyone should do that. Yeah. Keep a little
photo. Especially with your kids. They love it.
They love it. What they like, Trish, is pictures of them in the bath on the wall. So that when their friends come round.
We've just been asked to change all the photos in the downstairs loo.
We've been asked to take it down.
Little babies, gorgeous babies.
Sad moments.
Sweet little things.
So now we're going to talk to Louise.
Hi, Louise. Thank you very much for coming on to Postcards from Midlife. Now, one of the things we wanted to talk to you about was this talking about the menopause, perimenopause, talking about it out loud. You were really brave. You went to work and talked about it. And then you actually decided to tell the whole nation about it. You made the BBC talk about it. So it was really brilliant. But there's a lot of women who find it very, very difficult to talk about it. It's still one of those subjects that is a little bit taboo. And I've noticed sometimes men tend to sort of frown a little bit when I say menopause as well. So how did you start?
The reason it started was, I mean, I've been going through this. I can't even quite put a finger on it, but I'm only 51 now. I say only. I think it must have started when I was about sort of 45, 46. And we'll talk about, you know, the way it started, but the talking about it happened because at work, obviously sitting on a sofa under hot lights for 3.25 hours as a perimenopausal woman has different challenges. It mostly was about keeping the studio ice cold. And, you know, that's not comfortable, obviously, for other people, but, you know, absolute necessity for me. So eventually I said, I just kind of literally had to put my hand up and said, look, you know, there is a reason why I need the studio ice cold. And it's not because I'm being fussy. It's just that I'm perimenopausal and nobody needs to see the result of what's going to happen if the studio's not cold. Not to put too fine a point on it. So I kind of put my hand up at work and I kind of didn't sort of really, I just suddenly knew that I had to do that because, you know, otherwise it was going to just be kind of get increasingly difficult for me. So I told my boss and bosses, and actually they were very, very supportive. I think quite surprised, possibly, but very supportive about it. And then so I kind of already opened up the conversation at work. And then what happened was we kept doing stories about menopause, and I kept, every time there was a story, we just got an enormous response from people on Twitter or whatever it was, a huge response. And I just thought, you know, if I need, you know, I felt very kind of uneducated about it. If there's this huge response, we should really do something, you know, really start talking about it. And I talked to them over about a year, actually, about, you know, can we do something on menopause? Can we do something on menopause? And the time wasn't right. Anyway, but quite brilliantly, they decided to go all in and do this massive thing across the week. But again, you know, that was only going to work if I basically sat down and admitted, and it sounds like it shouldn't be an admission, should it? So you wouldn't think it would be that hard or that much of a taboo, but it definitely did feel a bit like I was kind of like walking over the edge of a cliff. And so I definitely felt really nervous about doing it. But I kind of realized that the only way for it to really work and to be, you know, really kind of open up the conversation was if I could be honest about it. So I did it with sort of trepidation in my heart, but I knew that it was kind of was going to be a definite conversation starter.
And had you talked, Louise, to your family about it, your children, your husband, before you did it?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Everything goes through the family. Everything goes through the family. And they, you know, they're pretty honest about it, the couple of years beforehand, because, you know, there had been points when I had really been struggling with stuff. And so menopause was, you know, and was definitely a very kind of fluid conversation already in our family. And, you know, we'll come on to it, but the ways I deal with it. But, you know, my family would, you know, if I was being particularly naggy or stressed, it'd be like, Mommy, why don't you go for a run? Anyway, so no, it was already very much a conversation that we had been having in our family. So to take it sort of to the nation was just an extension of that conversation, actually.
And were there moments when you were embarrassed? Because I get I don't know about you, Trish, as well. I get a bit embarrassed when I say...
Lorraine, I'm beyond caring. I'm just like, I'll say it anywhere. I'll say it to anybody because I think it's that important that it becomes a normalised part of conversation.
It does have a stigma, doesn't it? And it's interesting. Yeah, I think both ends of the sort of female reproductive system have a stigma.
Yeah. You know,
young girls are uncomfortable talking about periods. Society doesn't really want us talking about periods. And we also don't really want us talking about menopause. But we are trying to change that, aren't we? Yeah. And what you're doing at the BBC is trying to change that. What kind of response did the BBC... I'm assuming it was hugely positive. Response through all the content that you did.
It was very surprising, inspiring, kind of overwhelming. You know, people just, I think because I did the film, the actual film that went out on the BBC at a point when I wasn't on HRT. So I did it when I was, you know, HRT is really good for me. And I know there are, you know, people have different points of view about it, but I felt you know, very vulnerable, not myself, not happy in my own skin. So I couldn't film that film anymore because I feel great because I'm back on the HRT. So I think that kind of opened, I sort of said things that people hadn't heard articulated before and that I don't feel myself. A lot of women were able to relate to that. So they responded. And then what was, you know, there were so many responses from women going, gosh, I didn't know this, gosh, I didn't know that this explained how I felt and that this is what it is. And then another overwhelming response was from husbands, from children, from families, just going, thank goodness you've actually explained, you know, this thing that we've been going through and none of us understood why or that it was completely normal or, you know, there were things that you could do about it. So, I mean, it was an incredible response we had and I still have people getting in touch or phoning me up and even really, really good friends. So it was overwhelming and really... You know, I just felt so relieved to, you know, in some way, you know, made it easier for people.
And how do you feel now? Because you went through the bad times, you're on HRT, you do a phenomenal amount of exercise, you are a kind of Iron Woman triathlete guru, blasting your way across the world, swimming and running and cycling. How do you feel physically and mentally now?
I feel, you know, at the moment, strong, I feel. It sounds really... strange to this say this in some ways, but I sort of think that menopause is my superpower in some ways, because when days are good, they're really good and I feel strong and I feel confident and all those things that perhaps you don't feel when you're feeling perimenopausal or, you know, whatever it is. And the exercise is definitely something that helps me on a kind of daily basis, but also I think that helps with just, again, feeling fit, feeling strong, feeling, making me much more able to cope with just everyday life, you know, just having a job, having a family, having two dogs that need walking, you know, all that stuff. It's very helpful for me.
Were you always a sporty, Louise? I mean, I think you started doing triathlons in 2012. Is that right? With something to do with the Olympics?
Yeah. I mean, looking back now, it's very strange because the start of my triathlons and the start of, you know, perimenopause were probably exactly around the same time. So I don't know what I would be like as a triathlete if I didn't have this other thing going on as well. I might have been really good or not, but I don't know. I just don't know the answer. So, I've not been... I was really sporty at school. I loved sport. I particularly loved swimming. I loved racing. And then about 15, 16, I got to that really unfortunate stage where I was really muscly, shoulder muscles from the swimming. And I just literally one day looked in the mirror and just thought, I don't like those muscles. I think they look... And I, one day to the next, gave up swimming because I didn't like my muscles. And now, of course, you know, X million years later, I'm just like, yes, I've got muscles on my shoulders and that's great. So, you know, I wasn't sporty. I had a big gap. I mean, I went to the gym maybe a couple of times a week, but I didn't do any racing. I didn't do any, like, long runs. I just kind of, you know, did a bit of yoga, occasionally went swimming, and then and maybe some cycling classes, but that was it.
This comes up a lot, I think, with women. We can't all be triathletes, obviously.
No,
not everyone needs to be. You don't need to be. But sometimes in the perimenopausal years, it's like walking through treacle and you just can't imagine putting your shoes on and going for a run. You don't want to be seen in a class. You can't go to a spin class. I remember feeling incredibly tearful all of the time. What would your advice be to women to just take that first step to kind of, because it does make you feel much better exercise.
I can totally relate to that, that kind of anxiousness and feeling tearful. And What I would say, and there's lots of things I would say, is that, you know, there is never, apart from when I've fallen over, there's never been a swim, a bike or a run that I felt worse after. Do you see what I mean? So I kind of like, I'm very kind of goals based. And you can tell that by, I imagine, you know, by the sort of races that I've done, you know, goals are a really good thing for me. But they're sort of what I call micro goals. So, you know, like today, in fact, I'm not going to go out today for various different reasons. But, you know, like when it's raining outside and it's really cold, I think, oh, gosh, that's so miserable. And I'll put it off. But I go because I know that at some point on that run, I'm going to think, yeah, what? It's absolutely brilliant to be alive. There might be hail, there might be wind, but I'm out in it. So
the other thing you have to do is be on telly a lot, which is pressure. So you have to look a certain way, you have to be a certain way. Do you feel, as you've got older, that that's pressure at all? I kind of feel that, because I have to go and do lots of things as well through my work, and I'm predominantly involved in fashion, so people always look at me and think, what the hell is she wearing? She's supposed to know about fashion. So do you feel that pressure as you get older? Because that I found during the perimenopause, that really played into my confidence, thinking that I looked different. I couldn't quite fit into things. Mm. It wasn't the right... It was really difficult for me to get rid of that pressure.
I think maybe I was lucky because, the exercise started at the same time. So without knowing it, you know, I was kind of looking after myself in a way that I really did probably need to, not really from the kind of the way I look, but just from a physical point of view. Because, you know, so I think I was kind of, it was like happenstance and lucky. And actually, you know, I am much fitter now by mistake than I was 6 years ago. I mean, my poor makeup, the makeup artists at home, I've got them trained like triathletes now. Because, I mean, if you could see me now, honestly, I look an absolute shambles. I haven't brushed my hair. If it's the day when I'm not going into the telly, I wouldn't even put mascara on. So I've trained them like triathletes. So it's in transition. They used to have 45 minutes and they've got 25. And you know, I'm like, can you please find a TV presenter somewhere underneath that shaggy mop of hair? And they do. So there's probably more pressure on them than there is on me.
And you, it kind of made the headlines earlier this year when you decided to come off social media. That was quite a big deal, wasn't it? And I just was wondering, other than being sort of sucked into this world and it taking up too much of your time.
Takes up
all your time. Were you receiving comments that were sort of upsetting to you? Was there anything sort of ageist or sexist in there?
So I wouldn't say that they were particularly either ageist or sexist. I just found the whole tone of stuff toxic. And it's really interesting because I came off in sort of mid-November, essentially. What I found, and you know, I spoke to, I'm going to name drop here terribly, Billie Eilish today. What strikes me about my personal thing and speaking to people, you know, big megastars, is there can be, not for me 1,000 comments, but for her, you know, lots and lots of comments, and it's the one hurtful one that you remember, that you focus on, and you just, I personally cannot edit those or not be hurt by them. My children say to me, you know, they just don't understand. They're like, why are you on a forum where people are sending you nasty messages? Why would you be on that?
Teenagers control it quite well. They're quite...
Really? So people always assume that, oh, the teenagers are, you know, they don't know how to handle it. I think, you know, they've been brought up with it and actually kind of have a bit of a better perspective on it. And having been off now for, you know, nearly 3 months or so. So first of all, I stopped tweeting. But it's private, I tell you what, it's a revolution.
So one of the other things that we have found is that lots of women have contacted us to say, oh, I finally know what's wrong with me. I was going to resign from my job. I've been awful. I was going to leave my husband. Is that something that happened when you did the campaign?
I've met people since, like you will do, exactly. I met someone the other day who had resigned from their job because they had felt all those things of anxiousness and not feeling up to it and that kind of constant doubt and not feeling capable of doing a job which you are perfectly capable of doing or work are perfectly capable of doing. So, yeah, no, I've had so many people get in touch. And what was the really striking thing for me was there's the 34 kind of known symptoms, aren't there, of menopause, and there's probably many more than that. But what I was struck by was I went through those symptoms, and when I was feeling at my lowest, I had like 25. And it was all those ridiculous things like tinnitus and a heart palpitation. I had an ECG, feeling so tight-chested, my heart's going at a million miles an hour, not when I was running, just when I was walking or just being normal. So going back to the list and going back to all the things you were saying about thinking that you were going mad and things, I just think what I would urge people to do is go and look at the 34 symptoms, you know, and once you get past 10, you know, you're right in the zone. I mean, that's not in any way scientific, by the way. So I play menopause bingo with my friends. So I'm like, right, what have you got? And, you know, and you know, that's what you've got to do. You've got to have conversations. You've got to go and look. And then there might be something that's going on with you and you go, oh, gosh, that's actually making a whole lot of sense. And I just think for families, it's really important because it can explain to them why mum is not being mum at the moment.
Now, can I ask you, this is my personal fascination. How on earth do you get up really early? Do your job, because normally if I have to get up early, and I do have to do it now and again, I then want to come back home and have a giant cup of tea, some biscuits, a bit of a lie down. How do you structure your day? Because you've got to put training in. Take me through that.
So yeah, I wake up at the moment, I change it all the time. At the moment, I think this morning was 3:45. It is the middle of the night and it's invariably dark. There's about 2 weeks or 3 weeks in the summer when it's not dark when I wake up. The other thing that on a kind of really ridiculous sort of personal level is that we talk to, like you, I interview people all the time and we talk about, you know, sleep experts. And somebody said to me, so what time would you wake up normally if you weren't doing the programme? I'm like, 9:15, which is when the programme finishes. Then he said, oh dear. He goes, oh dear, you're struggling against biology. I'm like, yeah, I know that. Thank you. So the thing that I've learned about it, because otherwise, you know, my daughter's at 8, well, one's at university now and one's 15, so she's still at home. So I have, I can only survive by having a big sleep in the day. So I go to work, come back, I have it. And then I'm quite disciplined about it. You have to be incredibly disciplined, which is not really me. But I sleep for an hour and a half because that's what the sleep expert told me. Don't do more. Then it's time for bed.
When do you do the running and the swimming and the gymming and the...
Yeah, that's a good point. Again, sort of early on in the job, I realised... So I would sort of come home and then have a sleep, and then by the time I got awake from my sleep, it would be time to do the school run and it would be dark. So I kind of realised I wasn't seeing any light, just genuinely out in the light. It sounds silly, but... So I then started... before I even did triathlon, started like doing exercise in the morning when I get back from work. I get back from work about 11 or something. So go out then, you know, whether it's taking the dogs out for a walk or it's going for a swim, try and pack a bit of exercise into my life as a kind of, you know, for me, it's all like, you know, that's important from a health point of view. It's important from a kind of de-stressing point of view. But actually, I now know that I really prefer doing exercise in the evening. So thank goodness it's just beginning to get lighter now. So I'll, you know, sort of 6-7 in the evening, I like to go out for a run or, you know, in the summer, of course, then I go more to swimming in the evenings and obviously in a safe place where there are lifeguards. But so it's kind of part, it's very much part of my lifestyle. And I'm sure, 100% sure that it really helps, particularly coping with the hours as well. Because when I go to bed, you know, I'm also, because I've done exercise, I'm also physically tired as well. So I can go to sleep.
Do you have to eat a very healthy diet? Because I think my diet has changed over the menopausal years. I've become much healthier.
What have you done with it?
Well, I've eaten a lot more fruit and vegetables, which I just wasn't bothering with before.
Less alcohol.
And alcohol, I can't be doing it anymore. We can't handle it anymore. It just, it's sweating and hideousness happens in the night and you wake up anxious and
the
upset.
The night's come back.
You're about to do this amazing challenge for Sport Relief.
So we were going to go to Mongolia to do an ice triathlon. You can imagine why I did sign up with the word triathlon in it. In minus 30, and because of the ongoing situation with coronavirus and uncertainty, we are now going from minus 30 to plus 30, and we're going to...
Ibiza.
Namibia.
Oh, gosh, amazing. So is that changing your training then?
Is it? Well, I haven't got any time to train. I'm going in 3 days, so... I've learned how to ice skate. I bought these brilliant socks, which have got heated socks, which were fantastic. And yep, I'm going. Honestly, I'll send you. They're brilliant. They've changed my walks. They're fantastic. So we're going to the desert and we're doing 100 miles in the desert, and we're sleeping in tents in the desert at night. We're going to be on fat bikes. I say fat bikes. They've got really fat tires. Sort of cycling up sand dunes, then walking up sand dunes, and then apparently they might even try us skiing down sand dunes.
Sounds like great fun.
What's the insect situation in the desert?
Apparently scorpions. So you need to check your shoes before you put them on. Can you imagine? So we won't be running, but we'll be walking in sand. And if you ever, you know, walked across a beach in sand, it's just draining. So we're doing pretty much about marathon distance every day for 4 days. fingers crossed, we make it. The scorpion does not bite me and I don't need to ice skate.
I think you'll win.
The winning will all of us be making it. There's seven of us.
So we're going to be wishing you lots and lots of luck. And
we'll be mad woman.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Right, so Lorraine, we're both at that stage in the year. It's a bit of a first for me. We've got two children each about to hit exams. I've got my twins doing their GCSEs and you've got a GCSE and an A-level student in the house. Yes. How's that going for you?
Stressful. Oh. Stressful. I don't know whether I'm going to pass or not.
Are they stressed? Is it you? You're the one who's stressed.
Them? It is stressful because I can see their pain of having to do such a giant amount of revision and just that relentlessness of it. They're either looking at back on past papers, revising for new papers, looking at the timetable of what's coming up next, and then looking at the actual GCSE.
They look sound very, very organised, your two.
One of them is organised. The other one is probably more emotional and less organised about it. I mean, I just look at her room and think, how can you even...
Yes, not a how can you have a clear mind when all that's going on? Yeah, me too, exactly. But they do have different approaches, don't they? And they have to kind
find the
approach that works for them in terms of how they revise and also their kind of coping strategies, because it is stressful. And my sister's actually a teacher, so she's very good on all of this.
You'd be a good teacher.
Do you think I would?
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's my second career. Don't know whether I can work
that
hard.
I'll just do what you say.
Okay. But she sort of talks, because I said, should I be kind of, revising with them? Should I be? And she sort of says, well, you really need to work out whether your child responds well, because some children do want that input and some just see it as interference and they kind of really resent it.
I think the other thing, I mean, the point your sister makes as well is the do not compare them to each other. That way lies, you think, oh, well, they're both doing a maths and one of them spent 5 hours doing this and the other one appears to be on Fortnite playing. I don't know what she's doing.
They're
but
having
actually,
their little break.
It's they're
break.
Doing it. They do it and you can't say, but last year. So we could compare GCSE results from last year to the GCSEs happening now. And I've just not mentioned last year. The advice is always never compare them.
No.
What else did your sister say?
My teacher sister said that interesting about rewarding revision. She said absolutely not, unless it's kind of, don't give them money for doing revision or things like that, because she just thinks, well, they should be aware by this point in their life that they are doing this for their own good, and to have, especially with GCSEs, to kind of have as many choices as they can in life, which is what I'm trying to reiterate without putting too much stress onto my guys about it. You've had one that's already been through it.
Well, it'd be quite exciting for us because no one in the family's been to university. So we will have our first person at university.
Amazing.
If she gets her grades. So I try not to mention, because obviously I left school at 16 with no qualifications. Again, I try not to make that part of the conversation. There's a very good book called We Need to Talk, A Straight Talking Guide to Raising Resilient Teens by Ian Williamson, who is a psychoanalyst with adolescents. And he says you really do need to focus on the effort that they're putting in, not their achievement or potential achievement. He note that adolescents have a kind of strategy where if they don't think about something, it might go away because they're very in the moment. So you might be constantly thinking, exams, 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 exams. They might be able to switch off better than than you thought.
Mm-hmm. And I think if it does go wrong, you know, there are always options.
Yep.
It's never a disaster. You know, I think it's about, you know, stepping up for your child at that point, isn't it? And just seeing what you can do to kind of help them. But if they have to retake, they have to retake. It's not the end of the world.
You need to do a few anxiety alleviating fresh air after 6 hours of looking at physics homework.
Oh God, yeah.
Is always quite good. So I suggested we make a cake on Saturday with one of mine because she just looked like she was just so tired. She just looked so tired. And that took a bit of a time. And then we had to go and get the ingredients. I mean, it was weird. It was like having this child back again while she was doing these this big, really complicated stuff. But it just, I think it just switched her brain into a different. And sleep is so important for them. Really don't wake them up in the mornings at the weekends when they're revising. Let them sleep.
Yeah, they need the sleep. Sleep.
Sleep is good.
Right, so Lorraine, we have got to that bit in the show where you are going to tell me what's changed your life this week, what you've been trying, and what your nostalgia noodling thing
is. Trish, so this week, D-Nip. D-Nip has changed my life.
What the hell is D-Nip?
Do nothing in particular.
Okay,
D-Nip. I read it in a book somewhere, I think. Where of the weekend, where you fill your days and they accidentally get filled. With four children, they get filled because we're driving them all over the place, picking them up, getting things, sorting stuff out. And then I had like a brief moment where there was nothing happening and I thought, oh, that's good. I can get on with the hand washing. And then I thought, you know what, I'll D-nip.
Oh, good.
I will do nothing in particular.
And what was that? Just sit on the sofa?
Just sort of sat on the sofa and watched a bit of telly, read a couple of pages of my book.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's quite nice to just do nothing. We used to have, when they were little, we used to have DIY Sunday afternoons where they would say, what's happening now? What's happening? It's my own fault creating this need to do something all the time. And I said, well, nothing is happening. It's yours. You DIY Sunday can do whatever you like. You can go anywhere. So for 3 hours, they would DIY themselves. So this is my new version of that. What I'm trying is some stretching, Trish, because I did a TRX. God knows why. Well, I did a TRX
class. That's the thing with all those straps that you hold on to. And
it's very nearby and there was an offer on. Then the next morning, I just could not move.
Seized up.
And having asked experts about this, it's because I just didn't stretch anything out. So I've been doing a bit of stretching of a morning. That's quite useful. You feel a bit better. And my nostalgia noodling is the new mockumentary, Spandau Ballet. Gary and Martin Kemp, God love
goodness.
Them. God love them both, are making a mockumentary. Do you remember the Bros one?
Oh, I loved it.
Was
but that wasn't a mockumentary. It was a real one.
But it was hysterical because they took themselves so seriously. So I think that the Kemps, who are very lovable, have gone into this with a very... But one of them's 60, you know.
No.
Yeah, stop it.
Hot.
Favourite Spandau song?
Gold.
No, True.
No, True. True. Okay.
That's my favourite.
I quite like... To cut a long story short. Wasn't that the first one?
Might have been,
I think it was.
Yeah. I don't know as much about them as I do Kid Creole, but, you know. Mm. Now, what's changed your world this
week? Mine's a bit like yours with the old stretching. What's changed my world this week? It's not been able to walk very well.
Oh, true.
I did my right hip flexor in by, I've been working in an office this week, which I haven't done for a little while now, and I was sort of sitting on a chair. Normally, when I worked in offices in the past, for most of my life, I've had a special magic chair that you can adjust everything, and I had it all set to exactly all my sort of aches and pains for my back, my hips. Sat in a normal chair for about 8 hours working away, and then I had to go to an evening class, and so another 2 hours of sitting in a chair, and I could hardly walk by the end of it. I basically, my hip flexor. It's a bit like you. Been having to stretch.
Have you been lying down while Neil's been pulling your leg up in the air?
A bit like that. What I'm trying is nail oil.
Use
it? Well, it's mainly for my cuticles. You think I would know by now, but I've just got really dry, awful cuticles. So this manicurist, you've got to put nail oil on every night. So I've been trying that and it does work. So doing it in bed, but it's sort of spilling it all over the sheets and things. Bit oily.
Well, I had a manicure the other day. Mm. I don't know how I found time for that. And she afterwards, she massaged my hand and she went, old dry hands. I think it was lost in translation. I don't think she meant to say old dry hands, but yes, look at us. Old dry
hands. Oh my goodness. Yes, my nostalgia. Mine's kind of music related as well, in that This Charming Man by the Smiths.
Oh. See, I just don't put you down as a...
I was a Smiths Ranger. Do you want to know what that is?
Does it involve a uniform?
No. It sounds like it.
Is this why you're a vegetarian, Morrissey?
I used to go and see the Smiths when they were... Well, I was about 17, because I lived in London, and I could go and see them, and saw them all the time. And at one particular gig... It was brilliant! At the ICA, where there was a stage invasion, and I was one of the stage invaders.
Smith's Ranger.
And we were described in the NME as Smith's Rangers.
Oh, Trish, I love you a little bit more.
I know. Yeah. I know. It's good, yeah. Isn't it? My good. Little dark well secret past. But anyway, my nostalgia noodling moment was we were, this charming man came on the radio and my son was singing along to it. And so I told him my little story about how when that song came out, I remember going into R Price in Harrow, buying the 12-inch, going into school. I was in doing A-levels at the time, going to the sixth form common room, which when you opened the door was a fug of smoke. Everybody was smoking. It was absolutely hideous. And I was a bit of a sort of shy, quiet, wouldn't, you know, ever want to draw attention to myself. But I thought, right, today's the day. And I went up to the record player and put my 12-inch disc on and went and sat down.
Man,
it was my most brave moment.
That's
ever.
The you who you were yesterday that you
exactly.
were talking about once.
Yes, comparing myself. So it was quite, it's a bit of a milestone moment in my life.
Because
I still remain very... inspired by that little moment and this charming man. Thank you for listening to this episode of Postcards from Midlife. If you enjoyed the show, please do rate and review us on your app where you download the podcast, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.